Welcome to the Cloud Native Rejects podcast with our hosts, Kinvolk's CTO, Vincent Batts, and Mark Coleman, Director of Developer Relations at Equinix Metal. This podcast series will focus on the iconoclastic inventors behind the Cloud Native revolution. These are the people who think different, who reject the status quo, and in so doing, dare to risk rejection. In the words of Steve Jobs, while some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius, because the people who are crazy enough to think that they can change the world are the ones who do.
On today's episode, we have Charity Majors. Charity describes herself as an operations database engineer and sometimes an engineering manager. Currently, she is CTO and co-founder of Honeycomb, where she builds observability for distributed systems. She is the co-author of Database Reliability Engineering by O'Reilly. Hey, Charity, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. I am also the co-author of Observability Engineering with Liz Wong Jones, that is in pre-release right now.
So we're going to have a lot of questions today. We like to keep coming back to the rejection theme, but some of them I just have to ask. And I wanted to start off by talking about Linden Lab.
Yeah.
I actually never played Second Life, but I went to a Second Life meetup in Amsterdam at about, I put a question mark next to the question here because I want to say 2007, but it could have been a little bit later. And the reason why I kept going is because of the people. It was just such an incredible crowd. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you got involved in that?
I worked at Linden Lab for 5.5 years, and I barely ever used Second Life either. So I'm with you on that. But, you know, Second Life, it's I think it's interesting to remember, like, back then Facebook wasn't around. Like, there was a real possibility, like, this would be, like, the next generation of you know, IRC or, like, connectedness and everything. And I really do feel like Linden was ahead of its time, right? There were so many technical things that hadn't yet been, you know, the front end stuff wasn't yet there yet. The distributed system stuff wasn't there yet. Hell, like, I remember us having to invent our own version of Chef just to image, you know, thousands of machines nightly because the tooling didn't exist, right? And so it's a little bit of a bittersweet, you know, this podcast is all about, you know, failures and things that just almost didn't make it, almost made it, just didn't quite, you know. And you know, there was a time when Linden Lab was, you know, pulling out like full page articles and like Time and you know, People magazine and stuff, because we thought it was going to go that mainstream, and turned out not to. It turned out that there was a real natural, you know, it was too complicated for people to really grok without investing a lot of their creativity into it, a lot of their time into learning the client. You know, there weren't any real built-in games. Like, it wasn't a game, you know. Second Life is not a game, is what we kept saying over and over. It was a second, you know, reality. And it's seen as a failure in Silicon Valley, even though it is profitable and has been for like 10 years now and has millions of users who are shelling out monthly for it. So it's a really interesting failure. and the Linden diaspora is one of the best things in my life. You know, it's been, God, a decade and a half since I worked there. It was my college, basically, was going to Linden Lab and working there. I was in my early 20s. But the people that were there were amazing. And looking back, I'm like, it was a really diverse team. Like, there were lots of women, lots of queers, lots of trans people. A lot of people were really drawn to that sort of like counterculture. We accept you for who you are. You can be anyone you want online sort of vibe. It was a great place to get my fundamentals.
Yeah, what's the saying about building something in the nature of the organization?
Yeah, Philip Rosedale, the CEO, was a genius of organizations. You know, I remember the company values were things like, you know, do it with style. and you choose your own work. You know, what do we all want out of life, out of our jobs? We want autonomy, mastery, and meaning, you know? And all three of those were really, really high at Linden Lab. And I think they've carried the, you can see sort of the history, the family tree, the startups that have come out of it and the people who used to work there and the values that they brought with them.
No, yeah, I was just going to say, kind of being on the back end, that one of the things that I always thought was fascinating about Linden Labs, especially given some of these Snow Crash novels or, you know, Neuromancer novels, like working on the metaverse back end, like...
Yeah, I loved it. You know, but I said for years, I was like, I don't care about the front end products. All I care about is the back end systems, because it was super fun. Like, we were having to invent all this shit from scratch It was amazing, but I will say that it took me years to learn that I did really care about the front end system. I didn't have to be a really passionate user of them myself, but I did have to care. Like, I went to a startup after that was all about gamification and getting people to spend more money and go shopping more. And I got so cynical and so burned out because I felt better about the world when our services were down and I was their lead and only SRE, you know? So I feel like when you had the luxury of going, I don't have to care about the, it actually means you probably do care about them. And you're just like, I don't know. For me, I do have to care. You know, I don't have to be a user of the product, but I have to care about it in order to do my best work.
On the theme of not caring about other bits, when I saw that you'd written the database book, I was thinking, databases are one of those things that I got through my entire career, still kind of having them be someone else's problem. You know, you may have just answered the beginning of this story, but maybe you could tell us a little bit of the story of how you ended up writing a book on database reliability engineering.
I have an overdeveloped sense of responsibility. If something is around and it's important, I don't care if I'm good at it or not. I will care about it. You know, I feel like my people sometimes like, how have you achieved your success in life? And really, it's it's just I'm motivated by what must be done, not by what is intrinsically fun to me. And this is not humble bragging. There is a real downside to being this kind of person. Like, I would not know what to do if I just had a month of free time and a computer just screw around with. Like, and this is the kind of joy that I hope to someday wake up inside myself, but I haven't really achieved that yet. You know, I am motivated by what must be done. And so often that comes down to the data, right? The database, the data layer, the writing bits out to disk. You know, it's very uncompromising when it comes to, you know, mistakes or poor decisions. And it's something that if not done well, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when mom ain't happy, no one's happy. Well, if the data ain't happy, like, no one's happy. And so there's a real sense of mission there that's just always, it's always really necessary. And it's always kind of full of people dancing around it, not wanting to touch it. And so it's a grenade that I tend to throw myself on.
That's fascinating. I can relate to that heavily. It's one of those that I frequently have told myself also, like, oh, if I just had some free time, I'll do, you know, I'll be creative. And then it happens and I'm just like,
Right. I'm going to lay on the couch and watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Yeah.
Where or what do you think you would attribute, like, your personal resolution to? Like, this is something that's important. What do you think instilled that for you?
I had a really weird upbringing. I grew up in a compound in Idaho. We were homeschooled. We grew all of our own food. My parents were pretty hardcore, you know, religious right separatists almost. And so, like, the survival instinct, it runs deep in me, you know, and also the laziness. Like, if you got to get up at 5 a.m. to weed, you know, acres of garlic with your bare hands to survive, you'll do it. But, you know, if you don't have to do anything to survive, you'll just, like, lazy as shit. So, you know, I think that that has played out throughout my career in ways that I, you know, there are patterns that you see in your life. And I'm also just, I'm very much motivated by rage, anger, just sort of the fuck you instinct that it runs really deep in me. Like, the best way to get me to do something is to tell me it can't be done or that I can't do it. All the way back to college, you know, I was in the CS department and the professors were like, you should go back to music. And I'm like, fuck you. I'm going to be an engineer. And then, like, you know, when I was leaving Facebook, you know, and people were just like, this doesn't seem like a good idea for a startup. You know, I'm like, well, fuck you. Like, I'm going to do this. I feel like I burn it as a pretty clean burning fuel. I don't feel like it's toxic. It's almost just, like, hilarious. And it's like an overdeveloped reflex, you know, like when the doctor, like, bangs your knee with a little hammer, like, I kick him across the room. Also, as a woman in tech, I got to say, like, coming from where I came from, where, you know, all the women would grow up and get married in their late teens and have babies. And, like, the woman and men were totally segregated. And the fact that I was going to work every day and getting a paycheck was, like, the microaggressions, the shit that I know women go through never even registered for me. Like, it was almost charming, like, if and when I recognize it. And, like, so I think in some ways coming from a very misogynist background is a little bit of a, can be an asset, because you're just numb to the subtle shit. You're like, you just don't even notice it. I've had to, like, train myself to be more sensitive as I've become very, very more senior in my career, because I want to be sensitive on behalf of others, but, like, it never even dented me when I was coming up through the ranks. So it was just not even a thing.
That might be an overassumption on my part, but I think one of the ways that you potentially face public rejection is by how much you put out there on your blog, especially around topics that other people shy away from. I picked up on one recently that I enjoyed a lot, which was called Know Your One Job. Do you have a sort of filter around like what you should and shouldn't say? How do you approach something like that, knowing that it might be a sensitive subject?
If anything, publishing that blog post, I thought I would get a response of just like eye rolling, like, this is the most obvious thing in the world. Like, why are you even writing about this? I almost didn't publish it because I'm like, this is so stupid. Like, this is just so basic that why would anyone even want to hear this, you know? And in retrospect, like having heard all of the complaints, and to be clear, there were some very valid ones. I did think that it was a case of people responding to the reaction rather than responding to what I actually said. You know, like for 12 hours after I wrote that post, I got nothing but thumbs up. And then there's a cabal of feminists on the internet who really hate me. Like, they really don't like me. And they started like talking about it. And the stuff that they were saying about it, I would have been horrified if I had actually said those things that they said that I was saying, you know? And then there was a huge backlash from people who had read that all the things that they were saying that I had said. But I feel like the people who saw the post after that were primed to read into things that they weren't reading into it before then, if that makes sense. I don't know. It's complicated. You know, like, I do feel a responsibility. People listen to my words now. So I try not to alienate people. I try to be supportive of people. And I sometimes fail. And then sometimes people read things into it that were not my intent. And I just kind of have to accept that and deal with it and not get too defensive about it because it's not entirely under my control. I do have a filter, and I'm very much more careful about sharing things than I used to be and about writing things, but it's mostly around people. Like, I don't want anyone who I'm working with now to feel like I'm subtweeting them or talking about them or revealing something that's been said in confidence. And so I really try to write about things that are exclusively happening at the previous job or earlier. And maybe I have like new insights into it, but like I never have like my coworkers in mind when I'm writing a post, unless I've spoken to them first about it and gotten their okay and let them read about it, you know, a draft before I publish it, because that's what I worry about. You know, people out there on the internet, I'll do my best. There's only so much control I can have, but I have a lot more control and a lot more, you know, my words carry even more weight within my company. And I don't want anyone who works with me or for me or around me to feel unsafe.
I think the internet does an interesting thing for making people feel like they're, you know, first person and personal, even if it's just a one-sided conversation, like they follow things that you've said. And then like, they've already built this relationship that you effectively had nothing to do with.
I think that one of the most disappointing things to me is when people, there are some people who are out there who see me as an enemy of diversity. They straight up see me as like an enemy of DEI. They talk about me talking down about people who do DEI stuff. I've made some careless comments in the past, which I quickly retracted and like tried to clarify. But if you look at the company we've built, like there's a Teams page. You can see how diverse the company that we've built is. That doesn't happen by accident. That happens with a lot of fucking work. And it's disappointing to me when reality gets less weight with people than impressions or words or conversations. I don't know, whatever. I'm not just saying it's my work, like it's the work of a lot of people, but you know, it is something that's near and dear to my heart, because although I think it's in a way that's a little bit off kilter than maybe the way people who are arguing with me, because I see it much more as I came from nothing, right? Like I didn't have a computer growing up, and I went to college as a music major, and I dropped out repeatedly. Like I have never completed it. I haven't even completed high school, right? Like, so it's very important to me that we open the doors wider for people who aren't pedigreed, right? And often that overlaps with people who, you know, are minorities and, you know, women and gender minorities and racial minorities. But I think my heart goes out, you know, a little bit more to the people who have had nothing than people who come from Harvard and are, you know, women or people of color. I don't know. There are many axes of diversity. All of them can be very challenging. I believe in giving people chances. I also believe in running a pretty tight ship. And when it doesn't work out, sometimes it doesn't work out. And I would rather give people chances to prove themselves than not give people chances, is where I come down.
I wanted to talk about writing. You tend to write a lot. Is that a rhythm? Does that take discipline, or is that something that just comes out?
I am not a disciplined person. I'm not at all, which is one reason that I'm not CEO anymore. I think you really do need a very regulated, disciplined person at the head of your company, and I'm not that. I'm glad you say I write a lot because I feel like I don't. I feel like I'm always like, I told myself I would do a blog post every month this year, and I'm always 2 or 3 months behind that.
there might be a sort of Twitter survivorship bias here, which is that your blog posts get quite a lot of traction. But to be fair, you've written 2 more books than I have.
I also haven't tweeted in like a month and a half, and I'm feeling really guilty about that right now because it's my fucking job and I'm supposed to be tweeting and I just can't bring myself to look at it. But I emit words, I emit, whether it's blog posts or tweets, whatever, when I'm feeling very emotionally passionate about something, whether that's, you know, a rant or a slightly more civilized rant. This is something where, like, I was diagnosed last year with ADHD. Explains a lot about my life. A lot of the guidance in ADHD is like, there's like a spectrum, like emotionally, when you're red, yellow, or green. And they're always like, when you're super activated, when you're in the red zone, you know, and you're feeling very activated and your pulse is up and everything, they're like, don't do anything. I'm like, that's where I get all my creative energy. Like when my pulse is up and I'm feeling super activated, I will pound something out. It's where my energy comes from. And if I just wait until it's all tamped down, I produce nothing.
That was actually one of my personal mental challenges because I was in the age and time or whatever where like, this is a good box to put people in, but it was very much like a diagnosis and like, here, you need to be on meds kind of thing. And I was like, fuck that. And so like, I stopped all that when I was a teen, and it literally like years thought that I was just broken.
I have always felt like a broken human. Like I have never been able to keep a sleep schedule unless I'm piggybacking on someone else's sleep schedule. I went to college when I was 15, and from 15 to like 25, I was just figuring out how to exist in the world. And I would be up for 2 or 3 days at a time because hyperfocus is my only tool. And I could hyperfocus like a motherfucker. Like I can get anything out, but I need to have an open-ended amount of time in front of me. And it took me that long to figure out how to operate as an engineer, right? And then I figured it out. And then I had a pretty good rhythm. I had a partner who had a regular schedule I could piggyback on. And for like, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years or whatever, I was healed. And then I started a company. And I didn't realize that I wasn't going to be engineering anymore and that my coping mechanisms were not going to transfer to having to be CEO and having meetings all day and having a schedule, you know, that was just like rigid, involving going here and going there on time to everything and like, and just like prepared for everything. And I fucking broke because I compensated by not sleeping. Right. And so for like 3.5 years, I just barely slept and it was so unhealthy. And like, I ruined my marriage because of it, but like, I didn't know what was going on. I just thought that I was broken. Yeah. It's interesting because like, you know, I've never been able to be a software engineer because that's involved sitting down and planning what you're going to do for the next, you know, few weeks or months. But I've been great at ops because there's so much firefighting and so much like injections of, you know, stimulus and context switching. And you're just like, this matters. This is the only thing that matters. Right. And I'm like, I can just go deep into a hole and fix it. And it's interesting looking back and going, if I had been medicated, if I had had my brain getting regular stimulation, I would probably have been a software engineer, which is kind of what I wanted to do.
That's painfully real.
So I may have seen, or I may have dreamt, you talking about testing and production on Twitter. And as soon as I saw it go out, I just metaphorically grabbed the popcorn and watched the comments come in. Now, as with all things, this is a super nuanced argument, but how often do you think fear of rejection is why people respond so quickly and so vehemently to suggestions like let's test in production?
I think it's that people take their work very seriously and they very much identify with it. And choices that they have made them for probably good reasons and probably for reasons that save them and their teams some pain. And so like, I think a lot of people who reject the don't test in production, a lot of times it comes from places where the things that they have referred to as testing in production ended catastrophically, or they were the sign of really bad cultural patterns, right? Like maybe they led a campaign to reduce the testing in production to get people to actually write tests beforehand, or they see it as a zero-sum game where you can only do one or the other, or they've worked at places where they got their time just disrespected because people weren't doing things carefully enough and people weren't putting enough care into the pre-prod stuff. And so they now have just like this electric, just like, this is a terrible thing. This is terrible because I've experienced it and it's painful and it's irresponsible. You know, I feel like for the most part, it's coming from that sort of place, not a fear of rejection. I think it comes from legit lived experiences or ones that have been passed on, you know, generation after generation of engineers. This is apprenticeship culture, right? We all learn by apprenticing to ourselves. And in every culture, there are catchphrases that we use to signify bad things live here. And I think that for a long time, testing production was one of those catchphrases, like bad things live here, don't do that. Which is why it was such a fun electric phrase to start playing with, to like kind of, you know, to sort of represent the shift that I feel like is underway from, you know, we've got diminishing returns from all this pre-prod stuff. And now, like, I feel like the center of gravity is really shifting to doing things in production, you know, and building tool sets in production and having observability in production and, you know, and just acknowledging the fact that no matter how much we sink into like pre-prod testing, we all still have to test in production. And so I think that's just like, I've seen people go on that journey and I understand why they are where they were, but I also think that, you know, it's time to update our interpretation of the phrase.
So maybe we could flip that around. And instead of it being a fear of rejection, I was thinking along the lines of something like, you remember people used to say no one got fired for buying Oracle?
Yeah.
And it strikes me as the same thing. It's like, no one gets fired for doing those apprentice things that you were told.
No one got fired for saying, write tests first.
Yeah, right. No one got fired for having 100% test coverage, even if the ROI on it is terrible, something like that.
Exactly. This all comes down to risk management, right? And if anyone is telling you that there's zero risk, they're selling you something and you should stop listening to them, right? And it's our job as engineers to balance that risk. But you're absolutely right. No one ever got fired for saying, let's put it off. But the pain and the technical debt and the social debt and the socio-technical debt that it incurs and the way it slowly drags the organization down by death by a thousand cuts instead of like, you know, it's like, I think that that's our job as engineers is to start conveying that, yes, there is pain, but it's a healthy pain. It's like the pain that you get from lifting weights, you know, stretching yourself. You have to do it regularly. You have to do it often. You have to lean into it in order to not have that incredible heart attack of a pain of the entire site going down. It's a subtle argument to make, and engineers have historically not been very good at making the business case for this, which is, I think, what is starting to shift.
I think one of the things that I had some success with in a previous life around this was introducing people to something that I don't think many people know about, and I just came across the book by accident about systems thinking. And, you know, it goes really deep. I think one of them is feedback loops and the other one is trade-off diagrams. And it allows you to see that systems are very dynamic. And when you do things, not only are you often losing something else, but also like the outcome might not happen immediately. So you might also have to have patience. What other tools have you come across for helping people to negotiate this initial rejection of ideas that don't seem to fit their mental model?
I think the book Accelerate is a really well-written book that can be understood by anyone who works at a technical organization, not just engineers, right? The Dora reports and, you know, the stuff that Nicole Forsgren and Gene Kim and Jez Humble did around that is such a gift to our industry because it's research, right? It's not just anecdotes, it's research about, and so it's very hard to not come away with that being persuaded, right? Software is software. It doesn't really matter if you're doing medical devices or doing a website or doing, you know, whatever, like it still matters. Like how quickly you get that code out into the wild, you know, that delta between when you're writing the code and you have it in your head and when it's live in production is fundamental. I mean, the four Dora metrics are what? How often you deploy, how often does it fail, how long does it take to recover, and, you know, how something about the failures. And, you know, I think that like we're starting to figure out how to analyze teams, like how high performing are these teams using those four metrics. And I would add a fifth, which is how often they get alerted outside of business hours. You know, showing people research and anecdotes. People always want to see stories. Like, show me a story of a company that was just like me that went over exactly this journey over the last few years and what exactly their outcomes were. And that's really hard to give someone because every journey is sort of sui generis. But there is enough data now that we can start to say, you know, in the aggregate, if you're a software engineering organization, if you're not doing these things, because like if you look at the Dora metrics, like the top 50% of people of teams are like reaching escape velocity, they're becoming much more efficient and performant and you know, good at their jobs. The bottom 50% are losing ground year over year. And it's not because they're worse engineers. It's not at all because they're worse engineers. It's because our ability to write and ship code and understand it and debug it and maintain it is really not a function of an individual engineer's ability to know data structures and algorithms. It's a function of the socio-technical system that surrounds us, you know, the build systems, the CI/CD pipelines, the code review process. You know, it's all this process stuff that's in place that supports you doing that well. And incidentally, supports you becoming a much better engineer as you practice it that way. You know, like I've got this slide that's like, you know, look at these two engineers who just graduated and one of them is in a high-performing team and one of them is in a low-performing team. High-performing team gets to ship like 2,600 times a year and has like six major outages to debug. And the low-performing team has like six deploys per year and like spends most of their time in outages. And like, how much are they going to learn respectively over the course of a couple of years? And it's just, it's night and day. This is why I like to say, you know, great engineers don't make great teams. Great teams are what make great engineers.
Which dovetails right back to your Linden college experience.
No. Oh, it does. I got so lucky working around those great engineers who were shipping quickly. It was luck. It was. And I feel like any engineer who's out there looking to join a new team should be asking real hard questions about how high performing is this team, because it really sets the trajectory of your career over the next few years. And this, I got to say, this loops back to why I started the company too. Like, I know we haven't even started talking about like, you know, all of the ways that people were like, you know, for 3 years I was traveling the world telling people about observability. Everyone was like, what? No, we've got metrics. Metrics are great. Metrics are all we've always needed. This is all we ever need. And that was just frankly not true. Like, metrics strip away all that context at the time that you're writing them. And you have to do read time aggregation instead of write time aggregation. All the shit that goes into making an actual observability stack, which, by the way, all the people out there who are now doing observability too are not. And having observability matters because it's part of that really tight feedback loop, getting your code out into the world and then observing it and slicing and dicing it. What is my user's experience? Is it doing what I expected it to do? Is it doing what I wanted it to do? And does anything else look weird? If you don't have real observability, you're going to be stuck building these sandcastles of software in your head, trying to reason through it from first principles, or like reading through the lines of code, trying to figure out what your user's experiencing. And that's just batshit. Like, it doesn't actually work.
You're a really great force to be reckoned with, and I appreciate what you're doing in general and then specifically with all the different things that you talk about.
Well, thank you.
I want to say thank you for joining us, Charity. That was a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
If you want, you can catch up with Charity on Twitter at MipsyTipsy. That's at MipsyTipsy. And that's all for now. Thank you, and bye-bye.